This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to AM. Good morning. I'm Sabra Lane. Coming up, Donald Trump brimming with confidence about his COVID status as he prepares to head back out on the campaign trail.
Looks like I'm immune for, I don't know, maybe a long time and maybe a short time. It could be a lifetime. Nobody really knows, but I'm immune. So the president is in very good shape.
And how digital dating became a sexual predator's playground. Australian scientists have discovered the COVID-19 virus can survive longer on hard surfaces than first thought. The CSIRO says the coronavirus can live up to 28 days on surfaces like glass, stainless steel, mobile phones, even banknotes at a temperature of 20 degrees. But other health experts are being more cautious about the results, saying coronavirus transmission is very complicated. Isabel Rowe reports.
As the coronavirus pandemic took hold in March, health authorities spread this message.
Viruses spread when you cough and sneeze, and the tiny droplets land on surfaces others might touch.
The understanding of COVID-19 has since evolved. Most scientists now believe it's spread predominantly through the air to people in close proximity. But a new study from the CSIRO has found surfaces are perhaps a greater risk of transmission than first thought. Deputy Director of the Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness, Dr. Debbie Eagles.
Things like stainless steel, plastic, polymer banknotes, it can actually last a really long time at a temperature of around 20 degrees. So up to 28 days that it can last on those non-porous surfaces. Cotton, we tested, and it lasts less time there on cotton. And it also lasts a shorter period at hotter temperatures, which is important for us to understand.
The study also found that at 30 degrees Celsius, the virus lasted 7 days on glass and stainless steel. But at 40 degrees, it was only a matter of hours. Dr. Debbie Eagles says it's a reminder to clean your mobile phone screen.
So if someone's infected with COVID, then if they sneeze or cough onto that phone, then it's possible for that virus to stay on that phone if it's not cleaned. And then for that infectious virus to stay for long periods there if there isn't any cleaning in the interim.
But other health experts say the findings need some perspective.
I think surfaces are a possible danger, but they're much, much less risky than any coughs or sneezes in close proximity.
Professor Ron Eccles from the Common Cold Centre at Cardiff University in Wales says while the study isn't incorrect, it tested the virus under controlled conditions.
In real life, things are much more complicated. Viruses are spread in respiratory fluid by coughs and sneezes that gets onto surfaces. And that respiratory fluid is full of white cells, which have enzymes and antibodies that tackle the viruses. So in my view, the viruses will only survive for a matter of hours on surfaces. If someone has coughed and sneezed and got virus on their hand and they touch a door handle or something else, and then you immediately touch it after them, there is a possibility that you are going to get infection if you poke your finger up your nose or you poke your finger in your eyes. That's a possibility.
University of Melbourne epidemiologist Professor Tony Blakely has told News Breakfast he agrees.
Interesting, a little bit concerning, not too concerning though. I understand they were done in the dark, not in light where UV light can degrade it, but it's not the major form of transmission, that is droplets or aerosol.
The Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness wants the study to serve as a reminder to regularly clean things that many of us share, like EFTPOS terminals and public transport.
That story by Isabel Rowe and National Medical Reporter Sophie Scott. The US president's about to return to the campaign trail with a series of big public rallies. Donald Trump's declaring not only is he COVID-free, but that he's immune from the disease and not a transmission risk to others. Twitter has slapped a fact-check label on his tweet about that. The president's medical team still won't confirm if he's returned a negative test result. North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
First of all, I'm feeling great. I don't know about you. How is everyone feeling? Good? Hours after Donald Trump used the White House balcony to return to public campaigning, his doctors declared he no longer poses a transmission risk to others. In the president's mind, that means he's beaten the virus and he's good to go. Here he is on Fox News.
I want to start with breaking news, and that is the note that you have revealed from your doctor, which says you are no longer considered a transmission risk. Does this suggest you no longer have COVID, sir?
Yes, and not only that, it seems like I'm immune, so I can go way out of a basement, which I would have done anyway, and which I did, because you have to run a country, you have to get out of the basement, and it looks like I'm immune for, I don't know, maybe a long time, or maybe a short time, it could be a lifetime, nobody really knows, but I'm immune.
But neither the president nor his medical team will confirm if he's returned a negative test result. Despite that, he's heading to Florida tomorrow.
Well, the doctors, the White House doctors, as you know, are the best. And they said totally free of spreading. There's no spread. I passed the highest test, the highest standards, and I'm in great shape. And I have to tell you, I feel fantastically. I really feel good. And I even feel good by the fact that, you know, the word immunity means something. Having really a protective glow means something. I think it's very important to have that.
Donald Trump's been eager to return to the campaign trail, with polls showing his support continuing to slip despite his illness. After Florida, he plans to visit Pennsylvania. His Democratic rival Joe Biden is already in the battleground state, which is crucial to victory in November.
I think it's important the president makes sure two things. One, that he is clear. He is not a spreader like Dr. Fauci said, the super spreader event he had for the Supreme Court announcement. And secondly, I think it's important that he make it clear to all the people that they should be socially distanced. They should be on the lawn. That's fine. But in fact, they should be socially distanced and wearing masks.
The president's coronavirus infection and the outbreak in the White House has returned the spotlight to the pandemic this country so desperately wants to forget. But with daily cases again above 50,000 for the first time in 2 months, moving on from this crisis appears far from reach. This is Catherine Diss in Washington, reporting for AM.
The dating app Tinder has reinvented the way we meet new people, but its business model's also exposing users to sexual assault. A joint Four Corners and Triple J hack investigations uncovered how the app's internal features are allowing perpetrators to find potential victims and delete identifying and incriminating evidence. Avani Dias reports.
Inhale developing feelings for someone. Exhale, Chad's number from your phone.
With its slick ads, Tinder's become one of the top earning apps in the world, making billions of dollars.
When I first got on Tinder, I guess I was trying to find love or to try and find someone to be in a relationship with.
But a joint Four Corners and Triple J hack investigation has found the app's business model is enabling sexual predators to operate freely.
I first matched with him in 2017. I was in my last year of uni.
Brooke's a 25-year-old woman from regional Victoria. On the third date with her Tinder match, the man drove her to secluded bushland and persuaded her to get into the back seat of the car.
Then when he pulled my shorts off, I was like, no, like I'm really not in the mood. I don't want this. And he just didn't say anything. And he then pulled his pants off and just went for it and just raped me.
The next morning, Brooke decided to report the attack to Tinder, but the man had blocked her using the app's unmatch function, which deleted their entire chat history.
I guess that was one of probably the main reason that I didn't go to the police was because I didn't have his number, I didn't know his last name, I didn't have any photos or proof that we'd even spoken to each other before.
In March, more than 400 people responded to a Triple J hack call-out on dating apps and sexual assault. And Brooke's experience came up again and again. Alleged rapists using Tinder's unmatching feature to disappear from their victims' phones. US dating industry consultant Steve Dean says the function was created so people can quickly block a Tinder match they no longer want to speak to.
the fact that perpetrators are now getting a little bit wise to this and realizing that it's their way of escaping any kind of accountability, that's just unacceptable.
New South Wales Police Assistant Commissioner Stuart Smith says it significantly hampers their ability to pursue sexual assault allegations.
Obviously, as investigators, we're always looking for corroboration of the victim's version or evidence of the thing occurring. It wouldn't be our choice in terms of these things having blocking systems.
A statement from Tinder's parent company Match Group says it acts on every report received and vigilantly removes and blocks anyone reported for this behaviour, adding that it works with law enforcement to ensure that justice is served. Tinder brought in almost $2 billion in revenue last year, and Erin Turner from consumer advocacy group Choice says such a lucrative company needs to do better.
You can see where they're investing. They're putting their money and their time to getting people to pay more. They're not necessarily investing in consumer protections or safety features.
Making all the money from ads and people paying for, you know, the premium accounts, there could at least be a bit more transparency about what's actually happening when you do try and take those steps to report someone.
Erin Turner from the consumer advocacy group Choice there, and you can see Avani Dias's Four Corners report on ABC TV tonight at 8:30. Victorian schools are welcoming hundreds of thousands of kids back into the classroom today for a resumption in face-to-face teaching. There's no doubt the year's been anything but normal, with the pandemic triggering lockdowns and learning from home affecting students and parents everywhere. But many Australians living with disability had experienced a disrupted education long before the pandemic, with higher rates of bullying and disjointed classroom support. Some of those stories will now be examined by the Disability Royal Commission when it resumes public hearings today. With more, here's Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
For Danny Dixon, many of his high school memories are hard to recount. The 22-year-old Victorian lives with Asperger's and he was bullied for years.
There were a number of times when I was feeling unsafe and I told the school as such, but the school didn't take enough steps to properly rectify it. I had to take my own measures to keep myself safe by removing myself from certain situations.
And he says teachers failed to help.
Their fundamental attitudes towards disability were not very supportive. They saw disability as less of something that needs support, but more of a burden on themselves.
It's stories like this that will be examined at the Disability Royal Commission when it begins a second hearing into education this week. It'll hear about how students with a disability are segregated from other classmates and given schoolwork that hasn't been adapted to meet their needs. Mary Sayers is the CEO of Children and Young People with Disability Australia and one of the 25 witnesses who will give evidence.
We hear students who are locked in classrooms, who are taught that they're different, are taught that they're not good enough because they have to be taken out of the classroom, they're not included. So then we've got some really terrible things around bullying. You know, the bullying that happens for students with disability is, by all measures, one of the most significant challenges that they face. And often there's not school cultures that actually promote that whole inclusion. And so these really poor behaviours are allowed to happen. And if you like, are somewhat condoned by schools when they don't pay attention to it.
And she says her organisation will be talking about the long-term benefits of including all students.
The evidence is really clear that when students with disability are included, it's good for all students. So if you've never been educated with another student with disability, how are you going to, when you're an older person, employ someone? It's about inclusion in the community and it needs to start with education.
Danny Dixon is now studying screen media at university. He hopes teachers will have better disability awareness training so others aren't let down in the same way he was.
My second high school was better in regards to disability support, but one school being bad at support and one school being good at support isn't a good result. You need to have all the schools be good at support.
University student Danny Dixon ending that report from Naz Campanella there. We know that hundreds of thousands of people have lost their jobs due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and now many Australians say they're skipping meals or going hungry because they can't afford to feed themselves and their families. The charity Food Banks released its annual hunger report, and it shows that almost one third of people experiencing food insecurity during the pandemic have never been in this position before. Here's political reporter Stephanie Dalzell.
When the pandemic hit, international student Elizabeth Thankless was stood down from her job and her parents in India weren't able to help.
I couldn't get any sort of financial aid from home right at the beginning because all the banks were shut back in India.
She got by thanks to donations from the charity Food Bank, which sent rice and fresh fruit and vegetables to her University of New South Wales campus.
They were even happy to tell us if you're from the same household, you could just take a box completely home, which was really, really helpful.
Food Bank says international students like Elizabeth and casual workers had not had trouble affording food before the pandemic. And its annual hunger report shows that overall, almost one third of people experiencing what it calls food insecurity have never been in this position before. Food Bank's chief executive officer is Brianna Casey.
What we've also seen is a higher proportion of people experiencing food insecurity for the first time being women. So we have some particular cohorts who are doing it incredibly tough right now.
The report also shows those Australians who were struggling to obtain food before COVID-19 are going hungry even more often now. 43% going a whole day without eating at least once a week, compared with 30% last year. And one age group is suffering more than others. 65% of food insecure 18 to 25-year-olds are going without food at least once a week. Brianna Casey believes those figures are only going to get worse.
We have got a long way to go before we max out in terms of what the overall increase in demand is likely to look like in the months ahead. And it is extremely concerning to me that we do have so many Australians struggling right now.
And there are grave fears for the future. Food charities are reporting demand has jumped 25% since the JobSeeker and JobKeeper payments were reduced at the end of last month. The report also shows 80% of people on the unemployment benefit JobSeeker are worried they're now going to have to skip meals and cut back the amount of fresh fruit and veggies they buy. Social Services Minister Anne Rustin says the government has given Food Bank an extra $15.5 million since the crisis erupted, but she acknowledges the findings are worrying.
It is concerning that that's being reported because, you know, we have put a lot of support in either through the providers, the emergency relief providers and our food providers, as well as elevated levels of support for people. So we just need to continue to work with the providers and with the Australian public.
That's the Social Services Minister Anne Rustin ending Stephanie Dalzell's report. Aged care staff and providers are warning that key Royal Commission recommendations on improving infection control are impossible without more staff. More than 650 people have died after catching COVID-19 in residential aged care. The federal government's agreed to report by December on the progress it's achieved in implementing six recommendations from the inquiry's recent special COVID-19 report, including two relating to infection control. Annie Guest reports.
Looking after the elderly is a job aged care worker Fiona enjoys, but she says she and her colleagues can barely cope with the current workload.
Our facility, I can say the RNs have a workload that is unbelievable. To then take time out to do training, it just seems impossible.
Can you paint a picture of that workload that you say is too much?
We have one registered nurse for the 70 residents per shift.
To help avoid a repeat of the 650 coronavirus deaths in aged care, the Royal Commission recommended the deployment of accredited infection prevention and control experts to provide training to aged care staff. The accreditation is run by the Australasian College for Infection Prevention and Control. Its president, Phil Russo, is also the deputy chair of Australia's COVID-19 Infection Control Expert Group.
Currently, we have around about 60-odd accredited infection control prevention specialists across all states and territories. in Australia.
And that's compared to thousands of aged care facilities in number.
That's correct, yes.
Some of this training has begun in Victoria and Western Australia. The Royal Commission also recommended Australia's 2,700 aged care homes should have trained infection control officers on staff as a condition of accreditation, with the training requirements to be set up by an aged care advisory body.
So we need to get more nurses in these facilities, and we need a lot of those nurses to be trained and credentialed in infection prevention and control.
The Australian government spends more than $11 billion a year on residential aged care. It goes to providers including Baptist Care, which runs 12 facilities in WA, where Russell Bricknell is the chief executive.
So Baptist Care provides residential, home-based care and retirement living.
He says having infection control officers on staff will require more government funding.
For us, it will mean potentially putting on additional nursing personnel, but also putting them through some sort of credentialing process, and to get an understanding from the Commonwealth about how that might be resourced would be really helpful.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Health Department says it's the provider's responsibility to ensure staff have appropriate training and skills in infection prevention and control. And the government has already spent more than $430 million this year supporting infection control and training. The statement also says providers will be given specific guidance on how to meet the requirements after deliberations by the Aged Care Advisory Group.
Annie Guest reporting. It's been revealed that mining giant BHP has failed to meet some of the environmental standards attached to the licence for one of its giant iron ore mines in WA's Pilbara region. It relates to elevated dust levels in the nearby town of Newman, but the company insists it hasn't breached its licence. Sinead Mangan reports.
More than 1,000 kilometres from Perth lies the world's biggest open-cut iron ore mine, BHP's Mount Whaleback. Plumes of dust frequently blanket the nearby town of Newman, which local resident Angela Wilmot blames on the mining activity.
The other day there was an explosion that was so powerful, one lady told me that her outside bird bath fell off its thing and cracked. That's how powerful these explosions are, and they send dust extremely high up into the air, and we see them blow all over town.
For 2 years, the mother of seven has been chasing answers about the air they breathe, because long-term exposure to dust pollution can affect the body's respiratory system. The ABC has obtained BHP's latest annual environment report for the mine, which is prepared for WA's Department of Water and Environmental Regulation. It shows that in 12 months to June 2019, dust levels for the town set out in the mine's licence were exceeded 45 times, the company conceding mining activity was to blame on 35 of those occasions. Associate Professor Sue Reid specialises in occupational and environmental health and safety at Edith Cowan University.
And this is a concern for those who we would call at-risk population. These are the very young, the very elderly, and those with respiratory conditions.
BHP's licence allows for dust particulate matter of 70 micrograms per cubic metre, higher than the national standard of 50 micrograms in a 24-hour period. 2 years ago, the WA Department of Water and Environmental Regulation began a 12-month dust monitoring program in Newman. It ended 12 months ago, and the report hasn't been made public. The Shire President is Lynn Craigie.
In this report, I'd like to see how many times they've actually breached those conditions in the last, you know, however long, because I don't have knowledge as to whether they've exceeded the limits in recent times.
It's understood the elevated dust readings have partly been blamed on lower rainfall as well as mining operations. A BHP spokesperson says its measures for identifying, assessing and controlling dust are in line with the standards set by the state government, and that it's committed to improving dust management practices. Meanwhile, BHP plans to mine more iron ore in the Pilbara, which has automatically prompted a review of its licence conditions. In a statement, WA's Minister for Environment and Water, Stephen Dawson, says he's keen to see the findings of the licence review and the monitoring campaign to ensure the industry is doing everything it can to manage the dust. And he adds that there are other sources of dust, including from natural events and local activities. That's little comfort for Newman resident Angela Wilmot.
There's two options. Either there's issues with our air, and in which case we need to do something about it, and we can do something about it because there's always responses, or there's nothing wrong with our air and we get on with life.
Newman resident Angela Wilmot ending that report by Sinead Mangan. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Madeline Jenner.
And I'm Angela Wypierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The Olympics is meant to be apolitical, but there were boycotts back in 1980 and 84, and now there are calls for Australian athletes to stay home from the Winter Games in Beijing.
Today on The Signal, the case for boycotting the Games over China's human rights violations. Would it really achieve anything? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.